You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents
Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Home of such shows as Food with Mark Bittman, Big Picture Science, and Fork in the Road. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stoltzner.
The poltergeist is the most tantalizing of alleged paranormal activity for serious investigators. The stochastic nature of most ghost phenomena means we only have stories. The researcher's dream is to find a repeatable, testable platform for probing the most dynamic and energetic phenomena in the entire field. The more people experience in a poltergeist case, the more investigators want to go and try their hands at having a look. Some people want to get to the bottom of it scientifically, and others want to encounter evidence that there's more to the world than suggested by scientific materialists. But honestly, the tendency to categorize people as skeptics and believers is a false dichotomy, and even though I know this, I sometimes still find myself framing things in that silly binary. Skepticism isn't a team where you only get to be a member if you've achieved a purity of rational thought and reject all nonsense. It's a mental tool set for evaluating how likely something is to be true or not. We all need those tools, and all of us use skepticism in our lives. The controversy usually comes when the tools of skepticism are pointed at cherished beliefs. Oh, sorry, I'm starting to get all preachy there. Today's episode is about a strange case that emerged in the 1960s but found new life in the 21st century. You'll hear a brief recounting of the original events. We're going to be talking with author and researcher Richard Estep and the current owner of the home in question and co-author of the book at the heart of this discussion, Bill Bungay. Their book is called The Black Monk of Pontefract, The World's Most Violent and Relentless Poltergeist, and it's a recounting of the 1960s and 1970s events at this home, compounded with a book's worth of weird observations that people have had in the house since Bill started lending it out to researchers and experiencers. I think it was great that Richard and Bill were willing to come and talk with us, and I like their attitude about dealing with skeptical inquiry. I'd love to go investigate myself, despite knowing that often when you bring a skeptic on a ghost hunt, the poltergeists do get quite shy. Armchairs have a limited vantage point for investigation, and even Nero Wolfe had his Archie. But have a listen to our interview. Links to the book and the movie based on the story will be in the show notes. And this has inspired Karen and I to do some more digging on one of our most favorite categories of haunting. So stay tuned for some historical deep diving that is definitely going to grow from the seeds of this episode.
Monster Talk.
All right. Welcome to Monster Talk. Richard Estep and Bill, is it Bill Bungay?
Bill Bungay, that's correct.
All right, so let's do a little introduction. We've had on Richard before, but Richard, if you don't mind reintroducing yourself to the audience.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. I'm Richard Estep. I'm from the UK, but living outside Denver, Colorado. Paramedic, paranormal investigator, D-list TV personality, and author of 35, I think it is, books at this point.
Impressive.
And Bill?
Yeah, I'm Bill Bungay. I'm London-based. I call myself a creative entrepreneur now. I've set up lots of different enterprises, an ad agency. Now have a tech company, but a movie maker, writer, lots of different things I do. But for the purposes of this discussion, you'll be more interested to know that I'm the most haunted house in the United Kingdom, which is how Richard and I met. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah, quite a claim. So, Richard, we had you on last year. It was around June, I believe. And we touched upon the Black Monk of Pontefract. And so that's why we've brought you back on today, and Bill as well, to talk about this topic. And so we're talking about a house in Yorkshire in the UK, 30 East Drive. So could you, just to begin with, could you guys tell us a little bit about the connections that you both have to the house? Richard, if you want to start.
Absolutely. I read about this case as a boy growing up in the Midlands in the UK. Colin Wilson's classic book, Poltergeist, contains a pretty good account of what happened there, and I found the case fascinating. That and Enfield, to me, are the two kind of pivotal 20th century poltergeist cases, not that there weren't others. And 30 East Drive, as I'm sure Bill will talk about in a minute, was kind of dormant for decades and then exploded onto the scene when the movie about the case came out, the movie that Bill produced. So I'm fortunate that when I reach out to people and ask them if I can move into their haunted houses to write books about them, sometimes they say yes, which is exactly what Bill did. So I hopped on a plane with a small group of trusted friends and colleagues, and an adventure was born.
Indeed, an adventure was born. My connection to the house, to 30 East Drive, started a long time ago when I was an art director in an advertising agency. My copywriter used to talk about the family ghost, and would tell me the most fantastic stories about this poltergeist that lived in this house just around the corner from where he lived. His mother used to go there all the time and witnessed, you know, lots of different phenomena. He then bought me the same book that Richard mentions, Colin Wilson's book, Poltergeist. And I read all the words with interest, but I didn't believe a word of it. I was a rabid skeptic, but the storyline was one of the best storylines I'd ever heard. Poltergeist moves into council house, you know, it's a state sort of built house, tiny little three bedrooms, two and a half bedroomed house, really. That's a fantastic storyline, because poltergeists normally move into big, scary mansion houses and castles and such like. This one didn't, and so we turned it into a film. It took us 20 years. Pat had to learn how to become a director. Pat Holden was the director, and I had to learn how to produce a movie. And so, yeah, 20 years later, we got this film out. And actually, why don't I just go on to how I ended up owning it, because that's obviously a totally different scenario. I'd finished making this film. And I happen to have a client in Pontefract, the makers of Pontefract cakes, the little licorice cakes. And I'd finished a meeting with them, and I said, I'm going to go and visit the house that I made this film about. I'd never been to the house. I didn't feel like I needed to, really. And I got to this house, and it was for sale, and it was cheap. So I bought it. I thought I would use the house to promote my film. I'm an ideas man. So, So suddenly I had this house. I had a two-man premiere in the house, which I thought was going to get lots of column inches. Two people go to watch the film about the actual house in the house. And I got zero column inches, and I was suddenly stuck with this house. And that's where the, that's where the story begins.
It's a good job you didn't produce Titanic, Bill, or you would have been, that would have cost you a fortune.
Yeah.
So suddenly I end up with this house. So yeah, over to you guys.
You're going to make the Martian. We're going to start by going to Mars. What's like?
Yeah.
Okay, quick question for the American audiences. Now, this is, as I understand it, a council house. So the last time we talked to Poltergeists, I believe, was about Enfield, which was also council housing. Can you explain to American audiences what council housing is? Because I don't think we have anything quite like it here.
Government-subsidized housing.
Yeah.
So smaller, compact. My grandmother lived in a council house, a prefabricated house, growing up after the Second World War. Britain got a lot of council houses because there was this need to house, you know, a great many people and have them own their own home. So affordable housing subsidized by the authorities is the way to think of it. Bill hit the nail on the head. He said it perfectly. You know, you think of haunted houses, and something that strikes you about 30 East Drive is the sheer ordinariness of it. If you knew nothing about the house, you would walk by without giving it a glance. And that somehow made the case more interesting.
And you've maintained that. That's neat. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. Richard, you call this the case of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Why is this so? Can you give us an overview, or both of you, an overview about the Pritchard family and the strange activity that they experienced in this house?
Yeah. Why don't we, Bill, why don't you talk about the Pritchards? Cause you're kind of closer to that side of things, and I'll give my perspective after.
Yeah. Well, the Pritchards were actually the second people, the second family to move into 30 East Drive. The first were a family called the Farrers. And when the Farrers moved in, they eventually swapped the house because of, you know, the strange things that were already occurring. You know, when they moved in, literally in 1957, they moved in. And it turns out that the Farrers were having all sorts of strange things happen in and around the house, and particularly to their baby was getting scratched on the face, even though she was wearing gloves and so on and so forth. So eventually, Barbara Farrer, she bumped into Jean Pritchard, and they literally did a house swap. And so the Pritchards moved in, and the story that Colin Wilson writes sort of starts sort of mid to late 60s, really. So it's a good sort of probably good decade, almost a decade after they moved in. So one imagines things were happening, but nothing that would have caused them too much concern. But then, you know, as sort of luck would have it, when the children reached adolescence, which is often sort of seen as the catalyst for these events, the real, you know, proper activity started. I'm more than happy to tell you some of the things that happened. But the very, very first thing to kick things off that happened was Philip, the son, and his grandmother had stayed at the house when the rest of the family decided to go away for a weekend. And suddenly there was dust falling from below head height. Mm. So the dust was falling like a layer of dust, but not from the ceiling, some from a lower height, which is obviously very peculiar, but enough of it for it to settle. So there was dust settling visibly. And then pools of water started appearing on the kitchen floor liner. Subsequent to that, they actually got a plumber in. He lifted the lino. There was nothing wet underneath, no broken pipes or anything. And that was the beginning of what became probably the most, arguably the most active poltergeist haunting in history.
I kind of struggle with the word poltergeist in this case, actually, because it's more than that. We think of poltergeist cases as being relatively self-limiting in terms of time. And you know, we refer to them as outbreaks. You look at Enfield because we brought that up, and a comparison is almost unavoidable. You know, the family dynamics, I thought, were quite similar between the two cases, but they stop dead in their tracks after months or years, most of the time, a couple of years at most. What's unusual about 30 East Drive is that we're now measuring the activity in the house in decades. So I always describe poltergeist cases as kind of the shooting stars of the hauntings world. You know, they burn bright, they burn fierce, they can be terrifying, but then they fizzle and they're gone. That has not happened with this house. So there's something more at play here than a simple poltergeist outbreak, if simple is the right word to use.
I'm hard-pressed to think of a poltergeist case where you keep seeing entities so much as this one. So there is this whole, throughout all the books and things I've read about this, there's been this, there's the Black Monk, Mr. Nobody, and sometimes the family was calling him Fred or It Fred. Can you talk about the like this identified entity?
The Pontefract area is it's an incredibly historic area. There's been a huge amount of sort of national history occur in that place. We you know, a not insignificant number of civil war battles happened in and around 30 East Drive. There's actually a very famous battleground pretty much on the site of 30 East Drive. But prior to that, there was a monastery sort of in the area. And of course, the monasteries of the day, they were massive landowners. So they would have probably have owned what is now the Checkerfield Estate, the lands that is now the Checkerfield Estate. And the legend has it that one of those monks, and it is only legend, was a very bad dude indeed, and went about killing young girls. Now, what's super interesting, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will have watched The Ring. It's a fantastic film. But at the heart of The Ring is a well, and this girl climbs out of the well plays hell and havoc on anyone that she chooses to interfere with. Well, underneath this house, there is a massive medieval well, a very old medieval well. And so the legend has it that in order to dispose of the bodies of these girls quickly, the monk threw them down the well. And of course, if you throw a body down a well, you poison the well. He was subsequently found out, and it also appears to be the case that, I mean, 30 East Drive is on probably the highest point in that area. In fact, that's why the parliamentarians were camped there and they had their guns there, because they were actually at the same height as Pontefract Castle. So it's the highest point in the area, which is tradition had it that you would have an execution on the highest point so everyone could watch. So the thinking is that this monk was executed for his terrible deeds and disposed of down the same well because it was poisoned. And then they just capped it. So an ignoble demise for a bad monk. Now, cut to, 450-odd years later, and the local council, Wakefield Council, decide they need lots of new homes for the homecoming soldiers. A lot of soldiers were, they came back from the war. They didn't have anywhere to live, etc. And so they built this estate, and the very last house built, which is, we know this, we've researched this, the very last house built was 30 East Drive and the neighbouring semi-detached, which is 79 Checkerfield. Why it's the last? You could say, well, it was the last because that was just the order of events. Perhaps they saved the most difficult job to last till the end, because they needed to cap the stone, cap the well and make it secure for a building. But that's sort of, that's the backdrop to what is believed to be in the house. And hence, stories of the monk were kind of first formulated by Jean Pritchard, who was at the sink in 30 East Drive, and she felt something behind her turned and saw, something in a habit, a faceless thing in a habit. And so she then said, it's a monk. And so, you know, that sort of legend has kind of become the foundation of everything that happens at 30 East Drive.
Right.
But that story about the monk you described as not being true, but it's widely retold. Hmm. So why do we think it's not historically accurate?
Well, because we haven't managed to find any proof or evidence of there ever being murders in the area, you know, and particularly a monk. But, you know, of course, the counterpoint to not having found any evidence is if you're the church, you want to bury that. And you want to bury
in a well, right?
In a well. But then you have, by all accounts, had a very public execution. So I don't know. We haven't found any
proof. There might have been a record of that. Yeah, I think...
Unsubstantiated, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, Karen, go ahead.
When I hear about these stories, I hear them attributed to the 16th century. And I always think about the dissolution of the monasteries happening around that time with Henry VIII. And so I don't know if that would make it more likely to happen or less likely.
What happened then, of course, was that the monasteries were you know, broken apart. Any physical kind of relationship between that legend and where the monk may have resided has gone. You know, I think there are some sort of you know, a few things left, but nothing of any great significance kind of help the story in any way. Mm-hmm. There's certainly no files or folders.
The newspaper and television coverage of that period is notoriously spotty. So,
I tend to be very openly skeptical whenever a story starts with "it is said."
Yeah.
And so, you know, everything Bill said is established folklore, and it's important to emphasize there's no concrete evidence for it. However, a couple of things that are worth mentioning. One is the idea that we talk about egregores and thought forms, and if you tell a story often enough in one place, it takes on a life of its own. I've encountered that in numerous locations throughout the course of my career. So it almost doesn't matter if the story is genuine. If it's believed enough, if it's spoken with enough intent repeatedly, it manifests sometimes. The other thing I like to point out, too, is that although 30 East Drive seems to be the epicenter, Bill and others in the neighborhood have heard stories. This is not the only house that reports strange goings on. A number of neighbors, not just the directly connected neighbor, but other homes on that estate have experienced strange goings on too. And 30 East Drive tends to get the blame for it.
Fascinating.
Well, yeah, so we've been talking about reports and eyewitness accounts and things that people have seen. And we've also referred to the Enfield poltergeist a couple of times, and a lot of similarities between those two cases. And the Enfield poltergeist produced some interesting evidence of the alleged phenomena, things like those infamous photographs and the recordings. So is there any evidence for the Black Monk or for this case other than these eyewitness accounts?
From the contemporary time, I don't think there is. Over the years, there have been a number of photographs taken of varying quality. I mean, one that made the British newspapers was taken by an investigator there who caught what looks like the sleeve of a black robe or habit coming down the stairs in a hand, as if, you know, a monk's robe was kind of coming down the banister. So that's one piece of evidence. And various odd pictures have been taken inside that home. For my money, at least, some of them are credible, some of them perhaps less so.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Now your book is, I really thought this was interesting. I got the Kindle version. And instead of photos, there's QR codes throughout the book that will take you directly to photos. But it did create the very funny situation of me, you know, holding a device and taking a picture with another device while I'm sitting. You're like, what are you doing? I'm reading. But there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Credit to Bill for that idea. He had wanted to share as much evidence as possible with the readership. And one thing that really impressed me, I've worked with a lot of haunted location owners, and some of them are very hands-off. Some of them have an agenda. Bill basically said, investigate, by all means, you tell the story your way. But then when it came time to writing the book, which Bill and I co-authored, he wanted to put as much context in front of the reader as possible. So the QR system was his idea, and I think it's terrific.
Neat.
It is. Yeah.
So, Bill, you've described yourself as a former skeptic. So what do you attribute to converting you? And was it tied to this house?
Absolutely. I'd had a few sort of little peculiar things happen to me, you know, over the years. But, you know, I could easily dismiss, you know, them all, or at least I attempted to. And then 30 East Drive obviously came into my my sort of field of view. And being the owner, it's obviously meant that I'd still get to spend time there. Although I must confess to never having spent the night in my own house, because it genuinely terrifies me. But Richard has to his credit. I've since had so many things happen to me. It is beyond doubt that there is something real inexplicable happening at 30 East Drive, and I don't doubt in many other houses like it all around the world. Physical things. You know, I've had objects thrown at me. I've had, you know, gates opened. I've had footsteps. I've had, you know, knocking on cupboards. I've had just everything. It's been so fascinating. And I guess my eureka moment, my sort of conversion from skeptic to believer happens Valentine's Day 2016, I think it was. And I was there for one of my visits. It was during the day, broad daylight. I'm at the kitchen sink. I'm on my own in the kitchen area, and I'm just washing a cup, and I felt the instinct to turn. And as I turned, an object materialized out of thin air and was thrown at my head ballistically, like a bullet. It came at me so fast. And it was heading straight at my head, but it veered around my head, bounced off the window behind me, and landed at my feet, like perfectly at my feet. And I looked down, and it was a domino. I uttered a few expletives that we probably can't air here. Followed by, I've always wanted to see that. Now, how the heck did you do that? And then I spent the next 2 hours in the house with being bombarded by little objects, you know, some screws and a red plastic ball and a marble. And it was crazy. And at that point, I'm like, well, I can't not believe, can I? Because this is real. This is happening.
Wow.
The first time I met Bill, it was kind of interesting. I I as a paramedic by profession, I read people a lot. I read their body language. I don't mean this in any new age mystical way, but, you know, I get lied to quite a bit, honestly. And Bill no longer takes, if he ever did, takes offense when I, you know, say that I question the motives of pretty much any location owner, initially at least. And so I'll never forget meeting Bill for the first time, because I'd gone to 30 East Drive, was met by the neighbor who very nicely made me some tea. And then there was a knock on the door, and Bill put his head around the door. And instead of greeting me, the guy that had traveled 4,000 miles and some change to come see him, he looked up into the air at the ceiling and he said, "Hey, Fred, it's just me. It's Bill. I'm not going to be here long. It's okay. Be nice." He was talking to this, to his house. And were it, you know, anybody else, I would think that was quite strange. But it was obvious that Bill was not at ease in his own house, you know, and I see why he hasn't spent a night there. My brother, interestingly enough, spent 5 minutes in the house and had exactly the same reaction. My brother, the combat veteran, who has medals he can't show you for things he can't tell you about, refused to spend more than 5 minutes inside that house. So it's very interesting to see the effect it has on some people.
Wow. Well, I have to say that this place is definitely on my bucket list. I'm sure Blake's as well.
I was just literally just thinking that, yeah, if I ever do get over there, in addition to all the other things I need to do, yeah, I need a month. Yeah.
And I want to say that that's a realistic goal too, because the house is open for tours and I believe ghosts, overnight ghost hunts and things like that. So could you tell us a little bit, Bill, about the house as an attraction and what I presume is a legend tripping destination?
It more or less started off the back of me buying the house. People started contacting me saying, "I hear you bought the house, you know, can I visit?" Off the back of the experiences that those people started to email me, and images and videos and incredible things, I thought, well, you know what? I made this really expensive movie that everyone watches, you know, for free. No one pays for movies anymore, which is another reason why I don't make them anymore, Richard. But it turns out that, you know, the movie that I made, opened a lot of doors in terms of, you know, people weren't aware of this house. It wasn't as famous as the Enfield house. It was too far away. The story stayed in its locality, never really crossed out of Yorkshire. And so my film had the effect of telling people about this house. So as a direct consequence, the movie promotes the house, not the other way around. So opening the house to visitors was a sort of, I guess, a natural next step. I wanted to preserve it as well. I didn't want to, though my original intention was just to do the house up and sell it. When I realized that there was stuff, you know, happening still, I thought, actually, maybe there's, you know, there's more to it. You know, there's more to this than even I can begin to imagine. And I am very curious about what is causing, you know, all the phenomena. Having the house, opening it up to guests, in effect creates a constant flow of researchers. You know, everyone that goes there wants to, they call themselves ghost hunters, but they turn up with all these amazingly kind of creative brilliantly kind of engineered devices to try and see things that aren't there, you know, if you like increase their sensory perception, they come back with all sorts of incredible evidence to kind of support, you know, the fact that there really is stuff happening in this place. So it's now one massive test bed full of researchers, people are so excited to go in there and to experience it for themselves. And it's really important to add that we get a lot of people coming back over and over again. And I don't know about you, but I wouldn't go back to a place that promised something and didn't deliver. So
I don't know if the house opened doors, Bill, or if the doors opened by themselves.
I was thinking that.
Dad jokes aside, though, it's worth mentioning that looking at the history of the house, so and Bill will correct me if my recollections are wrong, but Mrs. Pritchard, the last resident of the house, lived there alone, I think maybe with her bird, if I recall correctly, for years. She lived mainly in the downstairs where she kept locks on the doors inside the house. And I believe the haunting was somewhat dormant. When the film came out, there's this explosion of interest. Bill buys the place, and he alluded to it. You have this constant stream of interested humanity coming in and out of that house. And I describe it as a feast or famine location. There are nights I was there, living there, and not a thing paranormal happened. And people complain about this all the time. People also complain that the whole thing is faked, which, having spent time in that house, I wouldn't have written about it were that the case. But these are not performing monkeys. They don't perform on demand. And Bill maintains, you know, rules. You have to be respectful, no provocation, things of that nature. But you have this constant stream of people going in, conducting experiments, telling the story, reliving the story, connecting with the house. And I think it responds to some people and some energies, if you want to. I know energy is a very overused term in this field.
Yeah.
Right? Controversial. But let's just say it responds or connects with some people better than it does others. And you can never predict the who, where, when, or not, or what. So when it's a famine night, it's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. When it's a feast, that house is truly strange. And it's now become a situation of, as long as people are coming in and keeping this story alive, it seems to be keeping the activity alive as well.
So, question for Bill. This is, and if you don't, well, I don't want to get into too much of the mechanics of it, but do you manage the rentals or the engagements of the house yourself, or do you use a service like a Scarebnb?
No, in fact, my wife Nellie manages the house for me. It's actually too much. She works on the house every morning, is often, you know, pretty much kind of overwhelmed by the amount of interest.
So, wow.
And I tend to kind of, you know. Well, I'm, you know, obviously, you know, I've written about the place with Richard, and I make content. We started a TV channel called haunted.com off the back of it. It's H-A-U-N-T-D, no E. You know, I'm the sort of the voice for the house, if you like. But so if anyone wants to be, you know, wants to kind of ask about the house or have some images reviewed or anything like that, I'll take care of that. But my wife does the management, because it's just too much.
So Blake and I have a considerable amount of experience with ghost hunting, I guess, for want of a better term, but from more of a skeptical perspective. So using the scientific method, the historical method, to look at stories such as these. So, Bill, as a former skeptic, what do you say to skeptics who argue that the phenomena in the house can be explained by way of natural explanations rather than paranormal ones?
That's an excellent question. I mean, it's the first thing I say is remain skeptical. You know, the first thing I'm really adamant about is that people should come to this house with a skeptical head on, but with an open mind. A skeptic is someone that sort of, you know, could be persuaded, as I was. Not rabid sort of non-believers. Obviously, going to the house and experiencing things for yourself, you know, would certainly be easily the best kind of maneuver in terms of convincing a skeptic that this is real. But if that isn't an option, I think you need to. I would recommend that skeptics read, you know, certainly read the Black Monk of Pontefract book that Richard Nye wrote, because it's not just about, it's not fiction. You know, all the stories that are in there are real and true. But of course, you know, using the QR code, you can actually see images and videos and kind of, you know, see the support for our hypothesis, if you like. So at the end of the day, remain skeptical, you know, find out for yourself. And I absolutely do not sort of, you know, hold people in a headlock and say, but you're wrong. I'm much more inclined to say, these are the things I've experienced. If you don't believe it, that's fine. But I'm telling you, these are things that I've genuinely experienced. And then, you know, I quickly move on from there to, but what is it? What, you know, what exactly is going on here? Which, of course, is, you know, my sort of main obsession, really, is to try and work out what the heck all this is about, really.
Right.
I'm going to kind of combine two questions here. Historically, I think generally in ghost hunting, poltergeists tend to be limited scope events that happen for a little bit. They're often centered around, you know, a teen, and then they go away. And that's not what's happening here. This did go away for a while, but then it came back again and has been enduring and recurring ever since. Can we talk a little bit about how this case does fit the poltergeist bucket and how it doesn't?
Yeah. One thing I'd love to bring up is, as someone who works in the medical field by profession, I'm starting to consider poltergeist cases in the terms of opportunistic infections. The idea that you can have a condition which predisposes you to a second condition, you know, you can have a cold and the flu at the same time. You can have a cold and COVID or the flu and COVID at the same time. And indeed, if your immune system is, you know, depressed because it's fighting off the one infection, you may be prone to an opportunistic second, I hate to say invasion, but infection, you know? So I kind of wonder if the original poltergeist infestation didn't lay the groundwork for whatever continues to happen in the longer term. And that's purely speculation and conjecture on my part. You know, we did not see that happen at Enfield. Then you see some more interesting cases in the USA, just to bring it to your homeland, Blake, like the Bell Witch, which also, if the claims are correct in Tennessee, the Bell Witch Cave is still somewhat active. And we are looking at now that's over 150 years, I believe it is, in duration, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
So again, clearly not a poltergeist case yet, but the initial phenomena as documented was textbook,
yes. Quite. I've been talking with Karen as we were preparing this episode, that I think, and I'm surprised I couldn't find such a thing, but it seems like a good project would be a historical list of sort of known poltergeist cases. Yeah, like when did they happen, where did they happen, and just kind of follow that along. Because, I mean, everybody knows the term, but it's kind of – it blew up really big in the 1920s. But I'd like to get more of a
some kind of ghost.
Yeah, I'd like some kind of just like a timeline of, you know, poltergeist in particular. You know, once the label's slapped on a thing, you know, where can we say this matches or doesn't match? You know, that I think that would be really interesting to see.
Yeah, you would think that book would fly off the shelves, huh?
Now that's nice, nicely done. So,
but in all seriousness, you know, I do think we love in this field, and as humans in general, we love to pigeonhole stuff. We like things that fit neatly in categories, and I think there are cases like East Drive which don't. I think Enfield, there are elements of that which don't fit so neatly. Certainly the Bellwitch and 30 East Drive have more in common with one another in terms of the sheer longevity of the case. Do they evolve? Do they morph into something else? Or are there multiple factors at work? And we're just kind of lazy, you know, looks like a poltergeist, quacks like one, therefore it's a poltergeist.
Yeah, yeah. It's like slapping vampire on anything that drinks blood. That's not necessarily accurate, so... there's lots of other sort of monsters that I think it's almost a sort of colonial dominism where you're it's like, no, yeah. If it drinks blood, it's a vampire. Okay. All right.
Exactly.
Well, Blake, we should start winding things up. Do you have anything else that you wanted to ask?
No, just after reading this once again, I'm reminded how much I'd like to sit down with Richard and have some beer and chat for a while. Next time you're in Atlanta, please let me know. And I don't know if you're coming back for DragonCon.
Yeah, DragonCon this year.
You'll be there? Okay, dude, I'll be there. We need to make that happen. We need to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So
excellent. I'm going to be giving a talk on my September release book, In Search of Demons, which will be an interesting thing to talk about in Atlanta.
So that'll be sort of a demonstration.
Yes, I love it. A demonstration, touche.
Time to start wrapping things
up. It is time to wrap things up because the puns are coming out real bad. Okay, so.
Mm-hmm. I do have one final question then, Blake, if you want to ask the final question. I just wanted to ask about the family. It doesn't seem like anyone has been particularly vocal about this case for some time as regards the Pritchard family. Has anything happened in that area? Have any family members come forward to talk about this in more recent years?
No. In fact, when we made when the lights went out, we obviously bought the rights to make the film from the family, from the son. But we were also under strict instruction to never contact them about it, to never involve them. They really wanted to put the whole thing behind them. And subsequent to that, I've had quite a number of TV companies come up to me and ask me to introduce them to the Pritchards. And A, I won't do it. And B, I don't know where they are now. So,
Could I ask, Bill, don't you think that speaks to their credibility? Because had they chosen to cash in on this, there could have been a lot of money in it for them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, definitely. You know, they would be getting checks, but they just don't want anything to do with it. So, I can appreciate and respect that. This is something that completely turns lives upside down when you have something like a poltergeist move into your life, you know, so it caused a tremendous amount of stress in the family.
Yeah. Sounds like some trauma there. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of trauma. Yeah.
So Bill, I know this is your first time on the show, but we have a sort of a signature closing question for first time guests. And that is, and I hope that Karen may have prepared you for this, but it's, what's your favorite monster?
I didn't think I did. I'm sorry.
And a monster can be anything you want. Does anything you would describe as a monster? It's like, what, do you have a favorite?
God, that's what a fun question.
Thanks.
I mean, I'm gonna have to go the Loch Ness monster.
Ooh, okay.
Classic.
Because I love the fact that. There's been enough, and do we know if these images are real or not? But there's been enough sort of the odd photograph, rather, that suggests that it's there. But people go all the way to Scotland to go and hunt for the Loch Ness Monster, and they never see it. And so for me, I'm kind of intrigued by that because, you know, one thing that we haven't had the time to discuss, although Richard has touched upon it, is just exactly, you know, in effect, just exactly what is a poltergeist. And Richard also rightly states that it does feel like the more people that go there and the more of the legends that they're aware of and more of the videos and the images and the stories they hear, the more inclined they are to have something happen to them. My sort of current frame of mind is that there is something, you know, perfectly logical happening, but it's whatever's happening is on a whole other level of understanding to where our current where science currently is. So we're talking, you know, quantum mechanics and just how how energy behaves and so on and so forth. So my sense of things is the reason why people see stuff is because at a subconscious level they would like to, and that's where my mind is at. And you know, there's an entire episode in that alone, but
there's hours and hours in that. It's so much to discuss there. Yeah. That's so true. And a compliment to Richard's book. He does a great job, Richard. You're right there. You do a great job of hypothesizing about what might be behind this. And there's so many interesting ideas there to think about. It's very thought provoking. I really enjoyed it.
You know, all credit to Bill, who's spent years thinking about this and is responsible for a lot of those hypotheses in the book, every bit as much as I am.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for reminding me. It was a co-written book. Sorry.
Yeah. And our listeners should definitely check out this book, The Black Monk of Pontefract, Pontefract. I say Pontefract. The world's most violent and relentless poltergeist. Excellent book, and very much up our alleys.
Absolutely. I'm going to have to get a paper copy to go. I've got William Rohl's The Poltergeist. I've got Colin Wilson's Poltergeist book. And I've got This House is Haunted by Guyline and Playfair. So I need to get your book up there too, Richard. So Richard and Bill.
Can I also recommend movie-wise a movie called The Parapod Movie, which Bill produced and I have no involvement with, but it is immensely entertaining. It looks at the paranormal. It's extremely funny, and part of it centers around an investigation of 30 East Drive. So you'll get to see inside the house and what happens when one very terrified human being is locked in there overnight.
Yeah,
that sounds fun.
It's creepy. Hilarious.
Well, thank you both for making the time to join us today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
You're very welcome. Thanks. Interesting chatting to you.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Richard Estep and Bill Bungay, co-authors of the book The Black Monk of Pontefract. Links to the book and Bill's movie When the Lights Went Out and other items will be in the show notes. We'll be digging more into poltergeist theory in future episodes, but in parting, I'd like to add this thought. As someone who felt they were experiencing a very scary haunting, I'd remind you that a haunting is a conclusion, and once you've decided on that conclusion, it invites every anomalous experience to accrete into that whole haunting narrative. The best way to avoid being terrified by a haunting is to examine each phenomenon on its own. Again, that's for things like apports and weird sounds and door slamming. But what about when people report
a free-floating, full-torso, vaporous apparition? It blew books off shelves from 20 feet away and scared the socks off some poor librarian.
Well, that's the cinema-inspired holy grail of ghost research and the sort of tantalizing reports we get in poltergeist cases, but which, to date, science has been unable to confirm. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. When the pots and pans are flying and the banging just won't cease, just turn up the volume on Monster Talk and find yourself some peace.
Been a Monster House presentation.